Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces WFIU listeners, interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. On this occasion, we welcome historian Robert Dalek, who specializes in the study of American presidents and U.S. diplomacy. His most recent book, published in 2008, is a biography of President Harry Truman. Bob, welcome to Profiles.
Nice to be with you.
Like prominent historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, you come from Brooklyn. Is there something about Brooklyn that produces historians?
I don't know. I'd like to think it produced interesting people. Of course, Brooklyn, when I was growing up, it was really one of the biggest cities in the country, 3 million people. Of course, it was part of New York City, so it was never thought of as a separate entity. But it really has a special identity, doesn't it? And what I always remember is that wonderful Thomas Wolfe story called "Only the Dead Know Brooklyn," and it's the high school I went to, James Madison High School. Ruth Bader Ginsburg went to that high school, and they had quite a storied number of graduates who they tracked down occasionally. So it was a huge community, and lots, of course, of second, third generation young people. The public school system was superb, and we made our way in difficult times. A lot of us born in the Depression.
Was history valued there? Is that what perhaps brought you to history?
Well, I think it was the fact that I grew up in a family that was very mindful of the world outside. My mother was born in Romania. She grew up in Manchester, England, and I kind of took my cue from her because she read. She was not educated. You know, she really had no more than an eighth grade education. But she read and found a fascination with the world of people and politics and presidents and power and international relations. And so it's not probably so strange that I ended up being someone who focused on these in my studies.
You went to Illinois for your undergraduate studies. Why Illinois?
Oh, that's a very amusing – to me, it's an amusing story. I was a precocious student and graduated high school in 3.5 years. And I had a good, strong record and thought I might go to an Ivy League school or go to Brown, or had a cousin who went to William & Mary, and I thought that might be an attractive place, Tufts University. I wrote to all these schools, and they said, sorry, we don't take a midterm. Well, I was at loose ends. What am I going to do for the next 6 months? And I was 17 and a half, and I had to happen to have an appointment with my dentist. He said, what are you doing? I said, I don't know. He said, why don't you become a dentist? So I said, well, that's not a bad idea. And he said, why don't you go to the University of Illinois, which is where I went to dental school. He said, wonderful dental school. So I said, fine. And so that's how I ended up going to the University of Illinois. And I enjoyed it a great deal and earned my bachelor's there in 3.5 years.
Is that when you decided to specialize in history?
It was. I, you know, was a pre-dent and science major for about 15 minutes. And I had an introductory history course at that time. It was being taught by Frank Friedel, who became the premier or famous Franklin Roosevelt biographer.
And he also wrote that wonderful book, The Splendid Little War.
That's right.
About the Spanish-American War.
Exactly. But Frank never finished that. He only got, I think, to volume 5 and only brought him down to the fall of 1933. So he was kind of stymied. But he did finally produce a one-volume study that he brought out. But he caught my interest, and I realized how much I was drawn to history, became a history major, and then went to Columbia and earned a master's degree and PhD in American history.
What then drew you to – your first interest was history of American foreign policy. What drew you to that?
Well, I was very interested in, understandably, in World War II. As an undergraduate, I did language studies. I studied some Russian and German. And when I got to graduate school, I did my master's degree in German history. But a number of the people I made friends with said to me, you ought to take a course with this fellow Hofstadter, and Richard Hofstadter. And so I signed on for his – or signed in to his doctoral seminar. And I found him such an interesting man, and we became friends later, and he was just an extraordinary historian and a wonderful man, wonderful human being. And he said, well, what do you want to do a dissertation on? And the papers of a man named William E. Dodd had just become available. And Dodd was for his day, a famous American historian of the Old South, but he was Franklin Roosevelt's ambassador to Nazi Germany. And I found this so interesting, the thought that, what did he think of Nazi Germany? What did he tell Roosevelt? What did Roosevelt understand? Because Dodd was there from 1933 to 1938, late 38. And I went to the papers. I got caught up in that. And that's what I did my doctoral thesis on. It became my first book, A Democrat and Diplomat, The Life of William E. Dodd. And that drew me into these diplomatic history studies. And so the next book I did was a study of all of Franklin Roosevelt's foreign policy, which was an overview, and I'm proud to say it won the Bancroft Prize and has read to this day. And it was published in 1979.
Now, that's a controversial subject in some people's minds. They're saying, well, did Franklin Roosevelt drag the United States into war? What's your view on that?
Well, Roosevelt became very controversial, understandably, because there were so many large issues that had to be addressed during his time in office, not just at home, but, of course, the whole issue of what did the United States do about the rising crescendo of tensions and the movement toward the Second World War. The country was intensely isolationist, and Roosevelt was always an internationalist, always mindful of the fact that the United States had to play a major role in world affairs. But Roosevelt was very manipulative. He was in many ways very devious. He understood this was part of American politics, and if you were going to be successful, you couldn't show all your cards to the public. Harold Ickes, who was his Secretary of the Interior, once said to him, he said, "You're the damn hardest man to work for." And Roosevelt said, "Why? Because I'm so tough." And Ickes said, "Nah," he said, "because you play your cards so close to your damn vest, nobody ever knows what the hell you're doing." And that was Roosevelt. And he did practice a degree of manipulation. So it opened him to later charges of having lied the public, for example, into World War II, which is simply not true, having arranged the Pearl Harbor attack, which I don't think has any credibility as an argument. But it produced all sorts of arguments about him as a manipulator. And he was very manipulative. But that's part of what the historian does. You go back and you make judgments on a president's judgments. And Roosevelt made good judgments. For example, in 1941, after the Nazis attacked the Soviet Union, June 22nd, 41, Roosevelt's chiefs, military chiefs, urged him not to provide any significant military help in the way of supplies, because we weren't sending forces at that time, but lend-lease. There was a lend-lease program, and they said, things are so scarce, the British are so needy, we should not squander these lend-lease goods by sending them to the Soviet Union, because the whole history of the time was that the Nazi war machine rolled over their adversaries. It gobbled up Poland. It had defeated the French army in Western Europe, supposedly the greatest land army in the world. And so they thought the feeling was the Soviets are not going to hold out. But Roosevelt made the judgment that they would hold out and that if they hung on for several months, their greatest ally would come along, which, of course, was winter. And that the Germans would get bogged down in the sleet and the rain, the mud, the snow, the freezing weather. And so he supplied lend-lease to the Soviets. And not that it made the underscore the difference in the Soviet fighting capacity, but it certainly did help them. And so we go back and look at Roosevelt and can say he made a wise judgment there. And when he was manipulative with the public about what he was doing in relation to the United States in World War II, he also made wise judgments because he saw that the United States could not stand aside, that Nazism and fascism and Japanese militarism were a direct threat to this country's national security. And so his judgments were really quite sensible.
Some people have criticized him, perhaps unfairly, because as his health declined in the last years of his life, that perhaps he wasn't sensitive enough to the changing geopolitical situation mm-hmm. that the Soviet Union mm-hmm. was going to be a threat.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, two things on that count. One is that they're absolutely right that his health was declining. There's just no question about this. He probably never should have run again for president in 1944. When he went to the Yalta Conference in February of 45 and Churchill's physician, a man named Lord Moran, saw him there, he said or wrote in his diary, the president is suffering from hardening of the arteries of the brain. He'll be dead in 3 months' time. And the physician had it absolutely right, see. But the bigger question is, did it affect his performance? And in my studies of Roosevelt, what I found was that there was a kind of continuity. What he was trying to do with the Soviet Union, he understood much better than he ever let on in public that we might not get along with them. He was suspicious of them. And so much so that in 1944, Winston Churchill and he met in Quebec at what was called the Second Quebec Conference in the summer of 44. And then they went to Hyde Park, New York, FDR's ancestral home. And there they signed what was known as an aide memoir, in which they agreed that they would not share the secret of the atomic bomb with Stalin, with the Soviets. In a sense, Roosevelt was saying, I don't know if we're going to get along with them. We may enter into some kind of direct tension with them, what, of course, became the Cold War. And he wanted an ace up his sleeve, which was to have an advantage over them with this nuclear weapon. And but he, in public, he never let on about this because he comes back from Yalta and he gives this famous speech before the Congress in which he says, this conference represents the end of spheres of influence, the end of balance of power diplomacy, the end of great power politics as we've known it in our time. And behind the scenes, before he went to Yalta, he says to a group of senators from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he says, gentlemen, spheres of influence are what carry the weight of history. See, absolutely contradictory with what he says after. So he knows, but he's a realist. And what he understands is the Soviets are positioned in Eastern Europe. They're going to dominate Eastern Europe. His hope, which of course proved fruitless, but his hope was that if we got along with them, if they understood that the United States and Britain and the West was not a threat to the Soviets, they would relax their hold on the domestic life of these Eastern European nations. As long as those nations had a pro-Soviet foreign policy, they wouldn't be so demanding and overbearing in dealing with them on their domestic affairs and the kinds of governments they would establish. But Roosevelt was wrong on that count. But there is a kind of continuity so that I don't see his health as having fundamentally tripped him up at Yalta. And also, Yalta became the emblem of Roosevelt's failure. Somebody wrote something called the Munich called Yalta appeasement. And the point is, Roosevelt was a realist in dealing with Stalin at Yalta. They had the power. They had the troops. They had the wherewithal to dominate Eastern Europe. And George Kennan, the great 20th century, probably the greatest commentator on 20th century American diplomacy, once said that the price we paid for the Soviets tearing the guts out of the Nazi war machine was their domination of East Central Europe. And I think that was a realistic assessment that Roosevelt made.
Now, we're talking about Roosevelt's health. You've also looked at the health of John Kennedy.
Yep.
To what degree did that influence his administration and his work?
Yeah. Well, again, it's a wonderful demonstration of how manipulative somebody running for the highest office and someone as president can be. Kennedy, from the time he was a boy, suffered from a number of health problems. First off, something called spastic colitis. And when he was 17 years old, he was sent to the Mayo Clinic, where they were trying to figure out how to deal with this disease. There was no real there was no cure for it, and there was no medication even that they could give that could. And it was a life-threatening disease. It was a real problem. Well, in 1937, steroids became available. And Joe Kennedy, his father, was, of course, one of the wealthiest men in the country, and he could afford to buy this new, really experimental drug at this point. And they began giving Kennedy the steroids. They didn't have a dose, and so they, in a sense, overdosed. And it caused him to have these terrible back problems. It contributed to what's described as osteoporosis of the lumbar spine, the deterioration of the bones in the lower back. And so his back problems were not the product of the PT-109 disaster and accidents in World War II, but the taking of these steroids. And apparently the steroids, according to the medical people I consulted, contributed to the onset of Addison's disease, which is the malfunctioning of the adrenal glands. And in the late 1950s or 1956, 7, 8, Kennedy was hospitalized a number of times, nine times actually, and once for 19 days, a couple of times for a week. Several times for a few days on a weekend. People didn't know about this. His health records and his physical condition was hidden from the public in 1960. And so there's this image of him as being robust, youthful, vital. Who could imagine that John Kennedy would have health problems if he became president? And the objective of the 1960 campaign was to hide that from the public. Now, Lyndon Johnson, who was the Senate Majority Leader, is running against Kennedy in 1960. And he, through his Johnson's campaign manager, is a man named John Connally, who becomes governor of Texas later and, of course, is in the limo with Kennedy when Kennedy's shot and Connally's wounded also. But Connally lets out stories about Kennedy's health. And the Kennedys are furious, and they deny that there's any significant problem that Jack has with his health. But there was significant problems. Now, the $64,000 question, which I confronted in writing my biography of JFK, was did it have an impact on his performance as president? I took the Cuban Missile Crisis, the most serious crisis of his brief presidency, and Kennedy started this business of taping conversations, and he taped what was known as the XCOM, the executive committee, which discussed the what to do about the missile crisis. And following those materials along, you can see that he was entirely in control, very much on top of things. Now, I had medical records. I was the first one to get into his medical records. And I could see the medications he was taking day by day. And he was on an awful lot of medication to deal with his back problem, his back pain, with his Addison's disease, with sinusitis, with something called prostatitis. And but it didn't seem to have an impact on his performance in this Cuban Missile Crisis. And while maybe it slowed him down somewhat, maybe it did have some sort of impact, I don't think it had any major impact on his conduct of the presidency.
When Kennedy was killed, the media almost treated him as a king whose life had been cut short and that he was a wonderful president. Later on, there were some people who said, well, really, he, except for the Cuban Missile Crisis, he didn't have that great a record. We're now approaching 50 years since his death. How would you rate Kennedy now among our presidents?
He can never be seen as a great or extraordinary president because he was there for only the 1,000 days. But it was impressive what his understanding was of the world. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, as I said, and would argue, was the high point of his presidency, There was the possibility, we know now from the availability of records and Soviet documents, that we could have ended up in some kind of nuclear exchange, because they had emplaced short-range, medium-range missiles in Cuba. And if, as some of the military chiefs, particularly Curtis LeMay, the Air Force commander, wanted to do, if we had bombed them, if we had invaded the island, the local Soviet commanders who were there might well have responded with turning a few of these missiles loose against the United States. And the whole objective of the exercise for the Soviets was they were so far behind in missile production and in the capacity to reach the United States that putting missiles into Cuba, they felt, would help to right the military balance. Now, we had put missiles into Turkey. We had put the Jupiters in Turkey, and the Soviets knew, well, we could easily reach the United States. And so they wanted to right the balance, so to speak, and put missiles into Cuba that would allow them to reach at least Florida and reach the southern parts of the United States. Well, Kennedy refused to follow the lead of the military chiefs here. He was really put off by what they were saying. And not that he took it off the table, but he wanted to try diplomacy first, which he did, and set up this what was really a blockade. And Khrushchev and the Soviets backed down, and we avoided this conflict with the Soviets. So that was a high point. Also, he went forward and won a nuclear test ban with them in the atmosphere. Not the, all testing, but in the atmosphere, which was at the time seen as a danger to health of people all over the world, and the pollution from it was disturbing. So that was a great achievement. In domestic affairs, it was a non-record, so to speak, because the four big things he wanted to do was to put across an $11 billion tax cut to spur the expansion of the economy, to pass a Medicare law which would provide health insurance to the elderly, seniors, a civil rights bill which would hopefully end the terrible crisis in the country, tensions, racial tensions between blacks and whites because of the abuse of black rights, and particularly across the South, and federal aid to education, which had been a very controversial business because of do you give money, federal money, to parochial schools? You see, violation of separation of church and state. Well, those four major pieces of legislation were left on the table at the time of Kennedy's death in November 1963, and Lyndon Johnson put all of them across. My supposition is that if Kennedy had lived, I think he certainly would have been reelected. He was quite popular by late 63. The likelihood that he would run against Goldwater, which Lyndon Johnson did in 64, would have given Kennedy the same huge advantage, and I think he would have won quite handily and would have carried big Democratic majorities into the House and Senate with him. And I think he would have passed all four of those laws. The other issue, of course, was Vietnam, and there's lots of argument about this. Would Kennedy have done what Lyndon Johnson later did, escalated that war, put hundreds of thousands of troops in there? I doubt it, because the evidence we have is that while Kennedy's rhetoric was quite militant and we're not going to lose Vietnam, stand up to them, the communist threat, what you see is that he was very dubious about putting large numbers of land forces into Vietnam. It was something of a trap, he saw. And he said that. He understood that. He told Arthur Schlesinger, the White House intellectual and historian, that it was like someone who is an alcoholic. You give them a drink, and they want another drink and another drink. And so if you put land forces in, and that's exactly what happened. Johnson puts 100,000 troops in July of 65. And next thing you know, in January of 66, he's planning another 120,000. And by the time Johnson is getting out of office, there are 545,000 American troops in Vietnam. And it's a stalemate. So we'll never know exactly what Kennedy would have done. Nobody can say with any assurance. But there's reason to believe that he never would have escalated the war to the extent that Johnson escalated it. But, you know, can you say this makes for a great president? Certainly not. But alongside of some of the other fellows I would describe as dolts who held the office, he looks pretty darn good to me.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. Our guest is historian Robert Dalek. And, Bob, you've selected Beethoven's Eroica for our first music. Why?
Well, I guess as a historian who had an interest in modern European history, the Eroica was tied to Napoleon Bonaparte, Beethoven writing about this most extraordinary of European leaders at the time. And so I think the connection to history and listening to that music always gives me the feeling of armies moving on the Great Plains and the Napoleonic Wars.
Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Welcome back to Profiles. Our guest, historian Robert Dalek. We were just talking a little bit about what Lyndon Johnson did in Vietnam. You have a, I guess we can use the term, massive two-volume history of, mm-hmm. of Lyndon Johnson. He was a very complicated man. If somebody asked you in 100 words or less to describe Lyndon Johnson, what would you say?
Oh, I'd say that Lyndon Johnson would say to me, yell at him, you can't describe me in 100 words. Because that's the way Johnson was. He was.
Did you ever meet him?
No, never met him. He was larger than life from everything I've ever read about him, and really a quite towering and in many ways overbearing sort of guy. People said that you never forgot Lyndon Johnson, and he did that on purpose. I mean, I love to tell the anecdote, which I found in one of the oral histories I used at the Johnson Library, that when he was a congressman, he had the largest office of any member of the House of Representatives. It was in the old House office building, and it was up on the top floor, and it was sort of out of the way, and there was no bathroom up there. And he wanted to hang on to this office because it gave him the distinction of having the biggest office. And when somebody would come in to see him, there was a screen behind his chair, and then he'd sit them down at the other end of the other side of the desk, and sometimes during the conversation with this person, they jump up, go behind the screen, and urinate in a sink. And what I said is that would you ever forget a congressman who jumped up and peed in the sink while he's talking to you? I mean, this was sort of but it was a very larger-than-life, overbearing character. And the wonderful anecdote about him and Everett Dirksen, the Republican Senate minority leader. Johnson got the first car telephone of any senator in Washington. And Dirksen calls him up and said, Lyndon, I want you to be the first one I call to my new car telephone. And Johnson said, can you hang on a second? I have my other phone is ringing. Well, that was Johnson. But what's fascinating to me about Johnson is that he was a man with tremendous ambition. Wanted to be the greatest president in American history. Wanted to eclipse them all, do better even than his great mentor, Franklin Roosevelt. And he had a kind of vision of what should happen to the country, of how the federal government should operate, should function. And, of course, we are at a moment in our history now when there's so much anguish over the state of the economy and the markets and the stock market. And what would a man like Lyndon Johnson have done about this? Well, Johnson believed in federal intervention and the use of federal authority to right the balance, to preserve wealth and the income of the middle class and working class folks, you see. And he had no hesitation about using the government in order to protect their holdings. And it was a spinoff from FDR. Now, Johnson was very mindful of the segregation in these societies, especially in his native region, the South, because he grew up, came from Texas, served as a member of the House, and then, of course, a long career as a U.S. Senator from Texas. He had this vision of ending segregation in the South. Why? In significant part because he did see it as a moral concern, as a blight on the Constitution, a violation of the equal treatment under the Constitution. But he also understood that segregation of the races in the South not only segregated the races, but it segregated the South from the rest of the nation. Because this segregationist system in the South made people in the rest of the country think of the South as sort of the crazy aunt you wanted to keep in the attic. What a bizarre place. What a strange thing. America that prides itself on equal opportunity, on equal treatment of peoples. Indeed, we're locked in a Cold War with the Soviet Union. And the Soviets are beating on us as being a racist society. And we're trumpeting the idea that we stand for freedom, for liberty, for equal justice under law, the rule of law. And Johnson understood that it put us at a disadvantage in this Cold War competition, but that also it punished the South. The South was the poorest part of the country economically. And also, nobody from the South could run for president until you ended the segregationist system. Just think of it. Johnson puts across civil rights in 64, the Voting Rights Bill in 65, and it dramatically changes the South. It integrates it into the nation's economic and political life to a degree it had not been such since before the American Civil War. Now, Johnson, Southerner, becomes president. Since Johnson, you've had Bill Clinton. You've had the two Bushes from Texas. You've had Jimmy Carter. You've had Al Gore from, you know, Tennessee, a border state, running for the White House. You've had this idea that, you know, running from the South is no longer a limitation on someone. You know, a guy like Mike Huckabee from Arkansas feels he can run for the presidency without a, by your leave. And then, of course, Johnson's greatest achievement, it couldn't be more current. For the first time in our history, we have an African-American as the Democratic Party's nominee for the presidency and a man who seems likely he may well win the White House. See, what a tribute, in a sense, to Lyndon Johnson. And yet, at the same time, Johnson currently, here we are in 2008. He died in 1973. So what is it, 35 years since, a little over 35 years since he passed away. He's an invisible president. Was he mentioned at the Democratic Convention in 2008? Does anybody talk about LBJ? Kennedy looms large. Ronald Reagan looms large, but not Johnson. Now, two things I think have worked against him. One is that he was not a very appealing personality. The anecdote I told, how overbearing he was, how crude. There are so many stories about his crudeness, his vulgarity, that offend people. But the biggest blight on his reputation, of course, is Vietnam. The fact that he leads us into the first war in American history that one can say we lost. And now with this war in Iraq, which has created echoes of that experience in Vietnam, because no matter what you say about Iraq, can one now come away from this saying, oh, we won a great victory? I mean, at best, you know, one can say at this point, well, there was a kind of stalemate there. And now we lose nowhere near the number of lives we lost in Vietnam. Over 58,000 American troops are killed in Vietnam. We've lost about 4,150 troops in Iraq. But still, there is an echo of Vietnam in Iraq, and it continues to cast a shadow over Johnson's reputation. So here's the man who was can be seen perhaps as the greatest domestic reformer in American political history, a rival for Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt probably bested him in the kinds of achievements he had, but Johnson was a serious competitor because, you know, I mentioned those four bills, voting rights, civil rights, I mean, you know, Medicare and federal aid to education, and but there was so much more. National public radio. National television, public television, the Freedom of Information Act, National Endowment for the Arts, National Endowment for the Humanities, environmental protections, which Richard Nixon then folds into the creation of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, safe tires, safe roads. I mean, so much that Johnson did that you can't even, you know, go through the list of all these things because he was a tremendous advocate of federal activism. And, of course, Reagan comes along and the mood changes and the Reagan mantra is government is not the solution, government's the problem. Well, the wheel's now turned. And I think we're back at a point where the front page of the New York Times recently had a story in which they're talking about setting up a kind of modern New Deal agency that is going to police these markets and these new financial instruments, which no one seems to understand, but puts all sorts of major banks and corporations in jeopardy. And it has echoes of the New Deal and echoes of the Great Society. So the wheel, in a sense, is turning, and it could be in the next over the next decade, Johnson will come back into focus as someone we hold in higher regard. But, you know, presidential reputation is sort of like a fever chart or like the stock market. It goes up and it goes down. I mean, there are some who are never going to really get that far up the ladder, like a James Buchanan or a Warren G. Harding, and some whose reputation will stand at the top for the longest time, like Washington, Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, you see. Harry Truman is fascinating. Truman, when he left office, had a 32% approval rating, and now he's seen as at least the near great president.
And both the Republicans and Democrats quote him.
They're claiming him like mad.
One of your most interesting books, given that you're a historian, yes, is your psychoanalytic study of Reagan. Mm-hmm. You, I think, at the time were associated with the Southern California Psychoanalytical Institute. What led you to do that kind of book?
Well, I was teaching at UCLA. I taught there for 30 years. I had never had any formal training in psychology, and yet I found myself drawn more and more into writing biography, writing about the presidents, about Franklin Roosevelt, about Lyndon Johnson, about John Kennedy, about Harry Truman now, about Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger. And so it occurred to me that it would be very interesting to probe this field of study. The Southern California Psychoanalytic Institute, I had a colleague, Peter Lohnberg, German historian, who is a German intellectual historian, who pioneered this at this institute in Southern California, of an academic going to the institute, taking seminars, and then becoming a clinician, which Peter is. And I decided it would be very interesting for me, not necessarily to be a clinician, but to study the field and see if it would help me in my understanding of these biographical subjects I was so interested in writing about. And so I went and spent 4 years doing the seminars. I did not become a clinician, but I found it quite interesting. And, you know, it's in many ways a controversial field. Like any of these, it's an art rather than a science. And I think if you try and take psychoanalytic theory and apply it wholesale to any of these characters, you're going to mislead yourself and mislead your readers, because someone like a Lyndon Johnson, who we've been talking about, one could say, well, he was an interesting narcissistic character who walked out of the pages of the writings of the famous Chicago psychoanalyst Heinz Kohut, who wrote about what was called self-psychology. But Johnson's more complicated than that. This wasn't a man who simply was afflicted by some psychological pathology. He had extraordinary talent and an extraordinary capacity to mobilize these neurotic ills, one might say, and turn them in constructive directions. Richard Nixon was able to do a lot of that as well, was a very tormented by inner demons, and yet, you know, reached the presidency, did some very impressive things. So, and it caught up with him, too. I mean, both these men were in many ways brought down by their own psychology, but they were also spurred to the top.
Well, was it hard to write about somebody like Reagan when you were in effect writing about the present?
It was, and that, I think, in a way, is my least successful book. That book was published, Ronald Reagan, The Politics of Symbolism, was published in 1984 in the midst of Reagan's reelection campaign. But I found him a very interesting personality and character, and very interesting in terms of what he reflected about the national mentality. Reagan, on the one hand, his rhetoric was all about a kind of 19th century American culture. A sociologist once wrote a famous essay about who American heroes are and what they tell us about the culture. And in the 19th century, we had the idols, what he called the idols of production. And in the 20th century, you have the idols of consumption. Now, Reagan was very much an idol of consumption. He never produced anything. You know, he wasn't Andrew Carnegie, wasn't an oil baron, did B-movies, but was, you know, radio, film, and television personality, you see, and very much an expression of this consumer culture. But Reagan identified himself with the culture of production of the 19th century. Hard work, small town, church going, family, those shibboleths, one might say, that Americans to this day find so enormously appealing. How many small towns are there? The great bulk of people in this country live in cities of 100,000 people or more, see. But Reagan was very adept at playing to that culture and was sincere about it. But on the other hand, it was very contradictory, because family man, he was the first divorced president in American history. He had a lot of tensions with his children, you see. Church going, he didn't often go to church. And he would say, well, he didn't want to disrupt the services because, you know, coming there as president and the Secret Service and everything. And these are the contradictions that are so striking in his career that I found quite fascinating.
Your son has written a book about Reagan. Is that an odd experience to have your offspring dealing with the same subject you've dealt with?
Well, I think it was more difficult for him than it was for me, because, you know, here he was entering into a field. He was an undergraduate at Berkeley, was a splendid student. He went to Columbia, where I was delighted he had the Richard Hofstadter Fellowship, because Hofstadter was my mentor, and he earned a Ph.D. in American history at Columbia. And he decided at that point he didn't necessarily want to be an academic. And so he did publish his dissertation, which was called The Right Moment, Ronald Reagan's Entrance into Politics. I'm speaking like a father now, but I think it's a very, very good book. And he's currently working on other writings. And he's currently a monthly columnist for this newspaper in Washington called Politico. But he does an awful lot of writing for the Washington Post, the LA Times. And he has one foot in journalism. But he became a speechwriter. And he was Richard Gephardt's speechwriter, Gephardt, the Democratic minority leader of the House of Representatives. So he's essentially he's a writer. So more than strictly being a historian, he's a very, very good writer. But, you know, you're proud of your children when they accomplish anything at all.
You're somewhat unusual for a historian these days, as historians nowadays tend to write for other historians. You're still writing for the general public. Do you think the history profession is going in the wrong direction?
Well, I have a certain tension with the profession in that regard. I'm retired, of course, emeritus, so I don't know that they see me as a real member of the guild anymore. But I admire and I learned this, you see, from some of my teachers at Columbia. There was Alan Nevins, who was really a famous journalist and a historian, Henry Steele Cumminger, who reached a large audience. Richard Hofstadter, his book, The American Political Tradition and the Men Who Made It, sold hundreds of thousands of copies and reached so many students in high school honors programs. David Donald, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Abraham Lincoln and of Charles Sumner, wrote, you know, for a large audience. William Lochtenberg, a beautiful writer, won a Bancroft Prize for his book on Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal. And this was sort of the model I found myself trained in at Columbia. Not that we weren't respectful of scholarship, you know, and if you look at my books there, some people complain they're much too long and they're sort of doorstops with these huge numbers of notes at the end. And so, you know, I do my homework and spend a huge amount of time in the archives ferreting out information on these various presidents. But I really do admire people who can reach a larger audience. And, you know, and we want to inform the public. You know, if they don't know about our history, if they don't understand the Constitution and a friend of mine told me recently there's a statistic saying that only 2 in 5 people in this country know that there are 3 branches of government. Well, you know, it's distressing to think that people know so little about the functioning of our democratic system. How are we going to preserve it if people don't understand that what it's about and that it's worth battling for?
What's your next book going to be? Jimmy Carter's one person in there that you haven't dealt with yet.
Well, you know, I'm in some ways I'm a bit stymied in that sense because to do one of these presidential biographies, I feel you really need a 30-40 year hiatus after a period of time after they left office, because that's when the documentary record comes to hand. I'm currently working on a book which I'll probably call Aftermath from World War to Cold War. And I'm looking at the leadership of this period, 1945 to mid-47. Extraordinary group of leaders, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Winston Churchill, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler's there, Mussolini, Charles de Gaulle, George Marshall, Dwight Eisenhower, Mao Zedong, Zhou Enlai, Chiang Kai-shek, Ho Chi Minh, Douglas MacArthur. The list goes on. And I'm looking at all these extraordinary, storied, famous leaders, and yet, it remains an imperfect world. We end up in a Cold War. We continue to fight wars, Korea, Vietnam, the struggle in Algeria. Charles de Gaulle, brilliant leader, and yet he rushes to get France back into Vietnam. And what a cost they pay in blood and treasure. So in some ways, it's something of a debunking book, not because I want to diminish the achievements of these extraordinary leaders, but what good is it if we just celebrate them as opposed to looking at their limitations and the human foibles that we see the world passing through in this very brief period of time, which I think is, you know, a kind of crucial moment in 20th century history.
And that brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been historian Robert Dalek. Bob, thanks for this conversation.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And to our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. We close with more music chosen by Robert Dalek. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
The program you have just heard was recorded in September of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.